Today's podcast is sponsored by HelloFresh. For a total of $60 off, that's $20 off your first three boxes, visit HelloFresh.com/GOT60 and enter GOT60. Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 3, Episode 9, titled Reigns of Castamere. This is the one. This is the one that everybody's been waiting for. I know I have.
It's an average episode of Game of Thrones.
Oh, what? What?
I mean, this is one of the greatest single episodes of Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
It is a real gut punch. It's especially if you know, like, there's a lot of gut punches in Game of Thrones, but you're kind of forgiven in the, you know, book three to kind of start, okay, well, surely they're going to round into some form of the good guys winning, right? So I was a little bit spoiled for the Red Wedding. I want to talk about my experience with reading it first and then watching it. What about you? Because this was, you know, this is one of the last episodes before you started covering Game of Thrones semi-professionally or whatever the hell we do here at Bold Move. So I imagine you weren't really plugged into all the fan sites that where I'm fucking minefield this season, to be honest.
I mean, but you didn't have to be. Right. Like, the Red Wedding is such a touchstone in Game of Thrones that you didn't have to be plugged into that stuff to be spoiled for it. So I kind of knew that there were some huge deaths coming up, and it's pretty easy to figure out who those might be.
So
I went into this and I was like, I didn't know exactly who was going to die, but I knew it was going to be a huge episode. I knew there were going to be big deaths. So it wasn't that much of a shock at the end when it happened.
So I had determined not to. I wanted to make this podcast a show only deal, which I think would have been a foolish decision in retrospect. But I was reading on one of the forums or one of the subreddits, and I came across this naked reference to the Red Wedding in connection to Robb Stark and his future. And I knew I was far enough in reading the books that I knew that there was some kind of marriage alliance that he was going to be put into. And I'm like, huh, well, that's a huge spoiler. So I just decided to go ahead and read the books because, like, you know, this, there's no way to do. I've since learned in 8 years of podcasting, there's no fucking way to really cover this thing and read feedback and stuff like that and not expect to get spoiled. So I went ahead, and when I got to the books, I guess I was expecting maybe Robb to die. But literally the entire Stark cause, like,
I mean,
almost,
the rebellion is put down.
Yeah, yeah. This
in this episode.
Yeah, this is like the Battle of Hoth. If Luke, Leia, Han, and everybody else we cared about didn't make it off, Mon Mothma dead, Crix Medeen dead,
right?
General Dodonna fucking dead. And that's the thing. Like, in the books, especially, it's brutal because, like, they name, like, all the bannermen that are going down and dying, and there's a lot of buildup and, like, really, like, weird, creepy things that Kat, is for all from her point of view, is noticing and making the dread increase, and just how decisive to where, like, I remember putting the book down for, like, a week or two because I'm like, you know, fuck you, Martin. Like, Now what? I guess wait for Danny or something. Like, it just seemed to be so bleak and such a gut punch. But then, of course, I kept reading.
Right. And it makes it literally the most memorable thing in the entire series. So.
And yeah, no. And like, I think there's a lot of compelling evidence that this is the scene right here that made the Double D's want to adapt the series as a whole. Like, they said that, like, this is the thing that they, you know, in their mind's eye, viewed as the pinnacle of Game of Thrones. And you can tell.
Yeah, they took care with it. We'll talk about it when we get to that scene, but it's a very well-constructed scene.
And there's a lot of interesting buildup of tension and then release and build it. So you can, like, they kind of, you can kind of be forgiven. They try to lull you into a false sense of security several times. Like, oh, well, this is the thing that Walder Frey's doing to fuck over to Starks. Oh, well, this is the thing. Oh, it's this insult. It's that insult. And then, you know, when the brutal killing comes, it's a real shock. And I think one thing that your show does that's superior to the books is showing, you know, actually taking the time to give Rob a little POV with his wife Talisa, so that the whole moment about naming the son Eddard, like, don't you want to teach Ned Stark how to ride a horse or swing a sword? I can't remember what it was. Like, that's that's a really
don't you want to teach Eddard how to lose a war by marrying the wrong woman? Come on, Rob.
Yeah,
don't you?
By clinging to his foolish concept of
following
honor
his heart
and righteousness
instead of his head.
Just the sheer brutality, the stabbing of Talisa in her stomach, the slitting of the throat, how many fucking crossbow bolts Rob takes, the murder of Grey Wind, which seems really get people worked up.
Yeah.
You know, infanticide and all that stuff. Yeah, you know, whatever. I sleep, and then Grey Wind dies, and it's, rah, you know, it's that Shaquille O'Neal meme. But it's a great episode, and it's not just the Red Wedding, although that takes up a bulk of it, because there's also the twin plot of Arya being so close.
Yeah, right.
So close to happiness and reunification, and getting snatched away, and Jon having to, you know, take a stand over old farmer, and the, you know, Bran warging into Hodo. Like, this they just really bring the thunder in this episode.
Yeah, no, it's a really solid episode, perhaps one of the best of the series, and I don't know, I'm ready to talk about it if you are.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say, like, it's always going to be a debate, like, what's the best episode of Game of Thrones, and I feel like sometimes, like, it's not even an absolute quality, it's like, what season it falls in and this overall strength of that season. But, like, you know, maybe you can make an argument for Hardhome or Blackwater or Battle of the Bastards, and certainly on spectacle, but for, you know, for gut punch and hard to beat this episode. Really hard to beat this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, before we get into the episode, I want to talk about a couple things here going on at Bald Move. We are covering Better Call Saul Season 4. We just got to the hump episode. We're halfway through Season 4. Don't forget, if you're a club member, you're welcome to participate in our Instant Talk podcast that happens immediately after the episode airs, where you can live chat to us through the YouTube chat interface. We also are seeing The Nun tonight, a very scary movie. We're going into the fall season. We're going into Halloween season. I'm looking forward to it. Trailer got a jump scare out of me. We also are starting our coverage, speaking HBO shows, of The Deuce this weekend, David Simon's latest, the creator of The Wire. We really enjoyed season one. It made a lot of noise at the Baldies last year, so we're starting our coverage of season two. That'll be on the Bald Move TV thread, or the RSS feed. Yeah, Bald Move TV feed. And finally, we'd like to encourage you, if you're an American, to register to vote. If you go to vote.org or headcount.org, either of those sites will allow you to quickly look up at the state that you live in and whether you're registered to vote. And that's important because requirements to register are changing. Their deadlines, like the deadline to register for this upcoming November election in Ohio, is the first week of October. And if you waited until the last minute, you'd be unable to exercise your rights in this democracy. So I encourage everyone to check to see if you're registered and to vote this November. Vote.org or headcount.org.
All right, let's get into the recap. We start with Rob consulting his mother about whether taking Casterly Rock is a good idea. Catelyn thinks it's a risky strategy, but she wants the Lannisters to feel what it's like to lose what they love. So go for it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a nice moment because Rob kind of comes correct to his mother. Like, maybe I should have listened to you more about some of these things. Like, a lot of these decisions I made contraindicating you directly led to the downfall of my house. And now I want your approval. I want, before I risk everything, because this is a real crossing the Rubicon, the die is cast moment for, as they both acknowledge, like, we either win a fairly decisive victory, but by no means the war, or we lose. Yep. Like, and they have, like, it's very ominous, like, all those lion pieces, like, arranged at King's Landing, like, if they can make it back, before they take the fortress, they'll be crushed. So, it's a sly scene, because it sets up the stakes after the thing that happens behind the Red Wedding. None of this stuff matters.
And that's, I felt this scene was a little bit tedious on second watch because none of this matters at all. And you can say that. You can go back and you can say that about all of Rob's stuff in season
right,
one through two.
Right, that's the danger of that attitude, yeah.
Yeah, but, like, this scene specifically, I was like, well, the planning, like, planning scenes don't matter at this point. They might have mattered up until the point where he decided to marry Edmure off, but now they don't.
Well, I'm going to vigorously disagree with you, because I think that this also adds a lot of subterfuge for viewers that are kind of caught, because there is hints that this thing with Walder Frey is really dangerous.
Sure, yeah.
But Rob planning this big assault with the Tywin, something that might come in a finale episode, and showing Walder Frey as an obstacle that has to be overcome and not a deadly threat, I feel like is one of the many techniques they use to kind of like smooth the like soothe the viewers, so they're left all the more open for the
absolutely first watch it works. Right. Second watch it's completely pointless and boring.
I mean, okay, that's an interesting.
Tedious. It's extremely tedious on second watch.
That's an interesting point of view and one that which I do not share.
Okay, so we move on to Rob arriving at the twins, where he apologizes to Walder Frey and his mini girls. Walder wants a look at the woman who stole Rob's hand from his daughters, and when he gets it, he makes some lewd remarks about Talisa. Then he announces that the wedding will commence, and they'll put this mess behind them.
Man, Walder Frey, what a shit.
He's great. Like, the character is a shit. The actor is doing a hell of a job being a shit. And I think, like, the two best things about this scene are Walder Frey and Edmure's reactions to all the girls.
Yeah, yeah.
I just love, Edmure does so much with just a facial expression.
Right.
In these scenes and previous scenes, it's so good.
Yeah, like who, I mean, who's the creepier guy? I mean, and if you say Walder Frey, is it because he's less handsome than Edmure? Because
it's because he's more upfront about his creepiness,
I guess. But Edmure sizing these girls up is also kind of gross. And I just, yeah, this guy plays Walder Frey, David Bradley. He's just really good at playing these crusty old shits, man.
Yeah.
Like he's got a standout role as the school janitor at Hogwarts in Harry Potter, where he plays a similar kind of like foil for the protagonists. And he's just really good at being this old, crusty, lecherous guy that has never given a fuck because he has this thing that's of strategic import and everyone's got to bow down and kind of scrape, and no one ever really respects him for that. And he just really, really plays that. And I also like, you know, Rob gives this apology that's as good as an apology as you can expect from a king. It's very eloquent, and it addresses the wrong that Rob's done to his daughters and all this other stuff. And then Walder's one slow clap reaction, because just what I was thinking, like, okay, well, that's a really good speech, but who gives a shit? Well, he's up there slow clapping it to bang that point home.
And I think, watching this scene again, they really hammer home the point of how Rob got in this situation in the first place, because when Walder Frey is up there and he's talking about Talisa's firm tits and whatever.
Snug fit or whatever.
Snug fit. Rob makes a move to, like, I don't know, cut off his head, shut him up, something. He's going to fuck up this situation again.
Yeah, yeah, unless his mom...
And his mom has to step in and say, fucking calm down, Rob.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All you got to do is eat a little bit of shit right now, and this war thing is going to go a lot better for us. And if you had done this in the fucking first place, like, I just want to see a 10-minute speech, a 10-minute dressing down of Rob in this scene by his mom in front of the whole court, because it'd be fucking what he deserves.
Well, in a few hours, he'll get brutally murdered. So that's almost as good as a dressing down.
There's your comeuppance.
This is another technique where, like, this is such a fucking insult to Rob's kinghood, even, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, this is the kind of shit that, like, the Mad King Aerys pulled with Tywin, taking, you know, improper liberties with his wife. And that was the king to one of his loyal bannermen, one of his lords paramount. This is just some fucking pissant bannerman of his grandfather's banner being a fucking asshole to the king. Like, mm-hmm. it's the temerity. And I feel like that's another thing where Rob passes the test. Frey claps and says, "Let the wall cave. Enough of this ugliness. Let's the music will be loud. The wine will be flowing." And you kind of feel like the tension drain out of the episode. And sure, I feel like in second watch, you know, contra to your point before, like I noticed these techniques and like, wow, they really did make a good effort of trying to, you know, rope-a-dope the wear their wedding clothes over their chain mail, essentially.
Sure.
And I thought that was pretty good. Also, like, I really liked them showing the other thing they did is showing the ceremonial offering of the salt and the bread and the sacred, you know, the Walder formally extending his protection under the light of the seven. Like, this is, I mean, it's all like, this seems silly to modern eyes, right? But like, in, you know, these cultural taboos carried the force of law back in the day. Mm. You know, it wasn't just like, oh, well, this is just some kind of little thing that we can set aside. And I mean, it's like as close as an ironclad guarantee that you can get. And I don't know that they really express that in the show properly to show like what a grave insult to the laws and customs of the land that Frey is about to do. Mm-hmm. But I really like them, you know, like for Frey just adhering to the letter of the law and saying, oh yeah, you're all under my protection and all this other stuff, and knowing full well he's going to fuck him over.
Yeah, I mean, he's giving Rob a taste of his own medicine.
One other question. Do you think that I don't think so. As I said, do you think Walder Frey was trying to provoke Rob into doing something so he could have a pretext for killing him without having to violate guest right? Because if Rob attacks him here,
right,
then Rob's the one that's in the wrong.
No, I think he's just trying to stick it to him, knowing that Rob won't make that move.
He almost
I know.
He almost overestimated Rob Stark.
Yeah,
because like, you know, his plan was to get the men drunk and like, you mm-hmm. know, and then none of that had happened. And if he had killed Rob, I'd probably the twins would be pulled down and thrown into the Trident. So, but yeah.
All right. Dario shows Dany a back door into the city through which they'll sneak in and open the front gates for her army. Jorah thinks it's a trap. Grey Worm trusts him, though, so Dany decides to go with the plan. And Barristan offers his help, but Jorah tells him to stay with the queen because he's too old to fight anymore. No, that's not what he says.
I think it'd be funny, like, because you know, Dario said, "I need your two best fighters," and Jorah steps forward as a "me and Grey Worm," and Dario should have been like, "No, I said her two best fighters." You know, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of it's interesting. Dany, like, you know, you're starting to see her trusting her advisors. Like, you know, what's Grey Worm's gut tell her about? Mm-hmm. Tell him about Dario. I like that. I like Ser Jorah trying to muscle in, and Ser Barristan try to muscle in on the action, and Jorah pulls the self righteous. But you're the Queen's Guard, and blah blah blah.
I don't know. It seems like Barristan might like that. I mean, if he's after the queen's heart,
right,
or whatever, then staying behind while Jorah goes off to potentially get killed is not a bad idea.
Right, right. But yeah, no, it's a solid plan, and it goes off without a hitch. Let's put it that way.
It does, yeah. So we go up to Sam and Gilly, who are continuing through the woods as Sam explains how they'll get through the wall via the Black Gate, which he's read about before. Gilly's very impressed at how much knowledge he has acquired from books, and they reach the wall finally. Gilly's very impressed by that as well. She's more impressed that she made it there alive, because mm-hmm. there's, you know, an old folk saying essentially that she'll never see the wall because she'll die first.
Literally, it's a folk saying for her folk. Her dad told her that. You know, Sam is a bit of a Mary Sue, I think, for like this is George Martin mm-hmm. as he sees himself, and her calling him this wizard of words, and Sam's reaction is simultaneously sweet and cringy, I think, at the same time. But yeah, like he just does a whole lot of Sam's a great character because he can do a lot of exposition. That's essentially, he has a bunch of arcane knowledge that almost no one else in the realm has, because he sits and he reads these old ass dusty books, and he knows about the Night Fort, and he knows where it's at, and he knows that there's a secret Sally Port and all that stuff. But no, I thought it was great. I liked, you know, this is kind of you know, a little bit of an Egret's reaction to seeing the South for the first time and Gilly seeing the Wall for the first time. Mm-hmm. And how fucking unlike, just, you know, the other night she was attacked by a White Walker, and now here she is, like Arya, so close to being what she perceives as safe.
We'll see if she ever actually gets through that wall.
If
the stories are true.
It's tragic.
I don't know. I haven't seen episode 10 yet.
Me either. We will have to wait and see.
All right, so we go to the Hound and Arya coming upon a man who is fixing a wagon wheel. The Hound helps him fix it, punches him out, and then makes a move to kill him. But Arya begs him not to kill the man, which he agrees to, but warns her that her kindness will get her killed one day. And crucially, as you can, you know, figure out from subsequent scenes, this guy is on his way to the Twins with a load of pork and wine.
He also is the most naive man in the realm.
He takes a look at the Hound and says, yep, he's a good guy.
Yeah, lift my wagon, brother. Yeah, you know, let me give you a hand. It's not, because again, the Hound is not like a, I mean, I don't know. Like if this were, I mean, even Brienne's a bad example. If this were like Robb Stark, okay, maybe he's unassuming, but this guy's a monster. He's mm-hmm. like 6'6". He's got this hideously scarred face. He's wearing full plate armor. Mm-hmm. The hell, man.
Probably covered in blood.
I mean, maybe this guy, he's thinking his best play is like, this guy's going to kill me. He's going to kill me. So I'm just going to act like he's a better man.
Right. There's nothing I can do to stop it.
Right. And hope his better angels win him over.
They do. His better angel, Arya.
Yeah. Although she concusses the fuck out of him.
She does, yeah.
This guy's not going to remember what the face of his wife looks like, but...
he could rebuild his life.
Yeah.
Get a new wife, like Walder Frey will.
maybe. I really liked also how Arya and the Hound both took turns just withering attacks on each other. Like, mm-hmm. Arya throwing, you know, the mountain holding the Hound's face to a brazier when he's a kid... is pretty low blow, but he comes back with, you know, he comes back with tormenting her about the knowledge of, you know, the fact that she's so close to being safe, and he knows what that fear looks like, and how the kindness is going to get you killed, and all that. I thought it was a nice duel for these two characters.
Yeah, and that's also, you know, coming up a little more, obviously, in the next scene with them. But we'll get there. Bran's group comes upon an abandoned plot of land and speculate that it's abandoned for fear of wildlings. And when a storm comes in, they take shelter in a windmill. In a windmill? In a tower? It's hard to tell. I assumed windmill because it looks a little bit like the building that Egret was pointing out to you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it could be like a grain silo or something. I guess
maybe it's just a tower. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
But it shows, like, here's some more exposition that there's this miles-wide tract of land south of the wall that the kings of old gave to the Night's Watch as a way for them to kind of, like, farm and live off the land without, you know, not having to be relying on anybody for, like, donations and things like that. Yeah. But, you know, everything at this stage, you know, 300 years after the Targaryen conquest, everything is in such disrepair that the Night's Watch can barely feed and clothe themselves, much less protect the farmers and all these cottage industries that had grown up to support the Night's Watch. So it's a consequence because the wildlings raids and all that stuff, they've all been abandoned.
And I think a little bit of, you know, unwarranted feeling of security with the wall. Mm-hmm. You know, like, the wildlings are never going to get through the wall, so what do we need to really actually protect these farmers for?
Right. And I also like Asha teasing Rickon about drinking blood from skulls, and because there's a lot of heinous shit said about wildlings right in front of Asha. It's like, oh, well, you're one of the good ones. We don't have to worry about you. Yeah, and it's just the foreshadowing of the storm coming and Hodor being uncomfortable with it. Is good, because that tension's slowly, you know, ramps up over the next few scenes.
Right. So John's group finds a man who breeds horses for the Night's Watch, which we kind of talked about how that goes. Over John's protest, the wildlings decide to kill the man and take his horses. John intentionally spooks the horses, alerting the man, giving him time to mount one and ride away, which the wildlings are not too happy about. Excuse me, the free folk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, don't use the wildling slur on them. I did like, you know, John tries to find this path of least resistance, like banging his sword against the rock. Like, mm-hmm. you know, is he helping the farmer? Or is he just clumsy?
Right. Whoops. Sorry, guys. My sword hit that rock.
Yeah. It's something that you can maybe a reasonable person could have a debate.
Yeah. But then when he goes Ygritte and kind of distracts her while she's got the perfect shot and then she hits the tree. That's pretty obvious.
I wonder. I feel like I wish that John here had made a defense. Like, look, this guy hasn't done anything to us. If you want to live south of the land, you know, the south of the wall, you're not going to literally be able to kill everyone in the Seven Kingdoms. So you might want to start making better tactical decisions of who you like. You know, Black Brothers, fine. They're soldiers. They're going to try to kill you back. This guy's just a farmer. Like, mm-hmm. we could tie him up and then, you know, we'll be past. I just felt like that. And I wonder what Corrin Halfhand would say from Seven Heavens, looking down and being like, yeah, way to commit to your cause, but boy, you'll stick us. You're stealing me, but you won't kill this fucking farmer. Mm-hmm. Like, what? It's kind of like the antithesis of the Stannis and Davos thing. Like, you know, for want of this dead farmer, the whole realm's going to burn. Come on, boy.
Maybe he's just getting anxious. You know, he's so close. Yeah. He's so close to being back at Winterfell.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's just, it's also just, it's pretty tough to kill your own countrymen in cold blood like that.
Yeah.
You know?
All right, the Hound is eating some hogs from the cart as Arya nervously overlooks the twins. The Hound tells her that she's scared that they won't actually make it there. Then Arya tells him he's scared of fire because of what his brother did to him. And the Hound makes a remark about her dead father, and Arya tells him she's going to kill him someday. Put a sword through his head, essentially.
Yeah, I kind of stepped all over the scene in my commentary to the last one, so there.
That's
there,
all right.
There you go. I do like how the thunder kind of rumbles into the next scene because it's, you know, I think it's clear skies here at the Twins, but it's the danger. Mm-hmm. You know, the lightning strikes and thunder rolling behind Arya's swearing of sticking her sword out through his eye and out the back of his skull.
And this is more just about showing, you know, how antsy Arya is to get to her family again. And kind of exactly where they are, right? They're within viewing distance of the twins, pretty close.
Right.
And they're about to head there. So then Bran questions how they're going to get over the wall. Until Jon's group of wildlings track the man on horseback outside of where they're staying. Hodor begins freaking out because of the storm, and Bran wargs into him to shut him up. Outside, Orel wants Jon to kill the man to prove he's one of them. Inside, Jojen wants Bran to warg into the wolves. We go back outside. Jon can't kill the man, and Ygritte backs him up. And the others decide to kill Jon for it, but Bran wargs into the wolves to save him. And John kills Orl, who then wargs into a bird, I think, which attacks John. Mm-hmm. And then John gets on a horse and rides away.
That all happens.
Yeah. It's kind of a schizophrenic scene between the inside and outside.
I do like the hush, Hodor, no more Hodoring.
Yeah.
That's a great line. And we see Brant, you know, This is the Qui-Gon scanning Anakin's midichlorian count and being like, it's off the chip. This is his power level over 9,000. Like,
yeah, it's impossible to warg into a person, but you just did it.
Right. And the implication is like, you know, maybe Hodor isn't like a fully there, fully intact, isn't at full mental strength. But the fact mm-hmm. that you can do it is very, very fucking impressive.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, like, what, it seems like it really knocks Hodor on his ass. You gotta wonder, like, you know, is this some kind of, I think the questions you're supposed to ask is, like, is this kind of, like, a black form of magic? Is there some sort of, like, if no one can do it, what is the implication if someone can? Like, and, you know, if Bran can train this ability, like, where does it go? Is he going to be able to command and enslave a whole army? Like, that starts, mm-hmm. this power scaling up starts getting very scary very quickly. Like, right now he's just shutting up Hodor, but what does he do with it tomorrow?
And it almost seems like, you know, that it's a pretty tropey thing, right? When the hero needs more power, they suddenly find more power because mm-hmm. they're in a situation that requires it to get out of it.
Right.
And that's what happens here. You know, he wargs into Hodor, didn't know he could do it, but he needed to, so he did it.
Right.
And then he wargs into, I guess, both of the wolves almost simultaneously, if not mm-hmm. just like back and forth.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if you're supposed to understand he warged into both of the wolves or he warged into Summer, and then Shaggy Dog's like, all right, let's roll, and his brother jumped into the fray.
They don't really I don't know if they really clarify that.
No,
but
they don't.
I assumed he was going back and forth between them now that he unlocked his new level of power.
Right, right. It did feel like a video game, right? Like, it's the mission that introduces the power. Now you can just do it. You know? Hey, you did it once. now you just press triangle three times and you warg into Hodor.
That's fine. I don't have a problem with that.
No. I also... There's a bunch of stuff to talk to. You mentioned Oral warging into the eagle as he died. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a concept in the books amongst the wildlings and the wargs that you have this, like, what they call, like, a second life, where if a powerful warg dies, he can choose to warg into an animal, and then his soul kind of lives in there. And what happens is inevitably... Uh-huh. They intertwine, and the warg has less and less control and becomes more and more bestial, and eventually, like, you know, it's not something you can continue to do over and over and over again, it doesn't seem like.
But maybe Bran could.
and it's also, I thought that was a cool little nod to that, and the Oral is so fucked. And it's like Jon Snow gives him this cold smack about, like... you're about to die and you can't do anything about it, but you're right all along, you asshole. And then here comes Eagle Oral to fuck up your face, pretty boy. you're not gonna be pretty no more for Ygritte. It's nice. A nice callback to their previous fights and the conversations with Oral and Ygritte and all that stuff.
Pretty small revenge there that he gets.
I have pretty much praised this episode to high heaven. I will say, after seeing this with fresh eyes, direwolf effects are still pretty dodgy.
Yeah, like, they're okay.
It's not like a scene ruiner, but I wish there was a little bit more reality and weight to, like, Summer tearing out the throat of some of these wildlings. We get to see these wolves, these direwolves, be badass so little amount of time. That whenever you see them kind of in the battle, it's like, yeah, and you really want to see what this like nearly horse sized wolf is going to do to these dudes. Mm-hmm. I recognize the inherent hypocrisy of saying there's too much Theon torture, but give me more dire wolf mauling, you know. But hey, I'm a complicated person.
And then, you know, John's in the wind at the end of this scene. And I don't think we get back to him this episode.
Yeah. So. I mean, that's... And I really like to see, like, Tormund trying to preserve Ygritte. He doesn't want to kill her. And mm-hmm. he's like, why do you want to die for one of them? And he's like, you know, kind of like, look at what's going on. And she's unbelievably pissed, but she just doesn't... She doesn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. She can't bring herself to... Like, I really thought in that scene, even though I've seen this before, I really thought in that scene that she's going to loose an arrow at Jon.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's not infallible. She took a shot at that farmer. I think she tried to hit him and just a tree got in the way. So, mm-hmm. like, I was kind of surprised that she... But that just shows the depths of her affection and how shocked that when push came to shove that he chose his duty over his woman.
Yeah, she overestimated his loyalty to her.
Yeah,
for
lots
sure.
Lots of overestimating of Starks and their qualities in this episode.
Or underestimated his loyalty to the Night's Watch South, you know?
That'd be the positive way to say
it. The north part of the south for Ygritte. So Dario and Jorah and Grey Worm make their way into the city. They are found and attacked by quite a few guards, but they're able to fight them all off. Except a whole bunch more show up. They surround them and the scene ends.
Yeah.
And you're meant to go, uh-oh, what's their fate going to be?
Yeah, pretty good action scene. Uh-huh. I thought there was...
The choreography is real strong.
There's a couple patches where it's a little stagey. Like, I caught Dario back blocking with the sword about a second and a half before a dude's attack came in. That was a little, like, maybe, is that the best? In the 20 times I had to film that was literally the best one you could find, editor. Apparently so. But, yeah, no, I quite enjoyed it. Plus, the three different, wildly different fighting styles.
Yeah. I really love Jorah's move to finish off the last guy.
Yeah.
The kind of double sword block thing and then gets behind him. And
yeah, no, there's a distinct, like, you know, Jorah's more of like a brawler. Like, you know, he'll be willing to absorb a few hits to get the killing blow. Dario's more of a whirling dervish type. And then, you know, the spear and shield combo of Grey Worm. It was all very interesting. Yeah. And it's just, I'm just at the edge of believing that these three best swords in Dany's army can defeat what felt like a million dudes, especially if they're, right. It's a slave
it's
army,
like
right?
So
it's,
eight-ish, yeah, maybe.
And yeah. Is their heart really in it? But like, I remember thinking, you know, when the next horde came in, it's like, oh, okay.
There's no way they can take them.
Right. Yeah. But apparently they didn't have to, so as, right. we'll soon find out.
All right, the Stark army fights outside while the wedding begins. And when I say fights, I mean like play fighting. Yeah. They're just having a good time, yeah, celebrating,
yeah.
Letting off some steam, essentially. Then Edmure is presented with his bride, who is actually quite a delight to him.
Turns out the Freys are capable of producing the odd smoke show.
Apparently.
Yes.
They clean up nice.
Yes, it's a good thing that a woman's value is judged solely on her looks, because, man, she could be...
And her weight, if you're Roos.
She could be, yeah, she could be stupid. Dumb as hell, or clingy, or bitchy, or whiny, or lazy as fuck, or trashy, but Edmure doesn't care because she's easy
on
the eyes.
Let's just say the first thing you're going to notice about her is probably when they unveil her.
Right, that she's just
not
the
looks.
Got the...
I mean, you can't tell if she's stupid or lazy or
right.
whatever other negative quality she might have, but she's good looking.
She doesn't got the F-U-F-F, the fucked up Frey face. The infamous Westerosi fuff that every lord fears when in a marriage alliance with the Freys.
So, yeah, they get married. I did think it was funny that he clearly gives Edmure the prettiest of his girls,
right.
Just to spite Rob. Like you can see it. He's looking at him throughout the entire ceremony going,
And if there was a little, like, and it'd just be a bonus to give Rob, like, if there was, like, a little fight between the two, because that'd be even a bonus in his eyes.
Yeah.
I also really like the blackfish during the ceremony,
yes.
catching the Frey girls, catching his eye, and he's like, ugh.
This wedding party.
Yeah, when the garter gets thrown, he's just going to run to north beyond the wall. He doesn't want to be anywhere near where the bouquet or the garter lands.
Yeah, it's good. And I mean, Edmure is doing so much with just a couple of glances here.
Mm-hmm.
So is the guy, you know, so is Walder Frey, so is Rob. Like, everybody's doing really solid work without really any dialogue.
Yeah, Kat's wry look at her brother as he's sweating, as Frey's bringing down his daughter. The withering look that Walder gives to Rob. There's a really good Roos work in this episode.
Yeah, but this scene and then at the
yeah,
very
like
end.
He's just very knowing.
Yeah,
in his dealings with the Starks here, which on second view is kind of delicious if you go into like really good villainy.
Yeah,
and I do like some good villainy.
Then we go back to Bran, who realizes that he can control animals and perhaps people at will. Jojen says that shouldn't be possible, but. It's apparently is. Bran tells them that he saw Jon and Asha and suggests that they head to Castle Black. Instead, he tells Asha to take Rickon to the Last Hearth, where the Umbers are at.
Mm-hmm.
And she agrees to that, even though Rickon doesn't really want to leave his brother. She's able to kind of soothe him and take him away. Big mistake, Bran. Big mistake. I know Bran doesn't know this.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe he needs to, like, work a little farther into somebody who can see what's up with the Umbers. The Umbers are not exactly friendly, or at least we're not sure if they're friendly at this point.
Yeah.
After the chopping of their father's head.
Oh, see, you're confusing the Karstarks with the Umbers.
Oh, fuck. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, no, the Umbers are like that. He was the guy who Rob's wolf bit the fingers off in the first season. And said, "Oh my lord, my king's meat is pretty bloody tough, you know." Because
he might not be happy about that.
Yeah, and the Umbers are like renowned for being amongst the most stalwart of the Stark Bannermen. So it's a pretty good plan to take him there.
Yeah.
The only thing I would criticize the scene a little bit is I felt like they made Asha a little bit over. I mean, you know, like, yeah, I guess they've taken her in and they've done all right by her, but she's still been a captive slave of their household, and I felt like the whole, you know, take care of him, he means the world to me, was a bit much.
Yeah.
A bit much. I didn't buy it from Asha. Like, I think Asha's a good person, and that's why she's taking care of this child,
mm-hmm.
And also she wants to be safe from the White Walkers, but, like, you don't have to gild the lily like that, Asha. Have some pride in yourself, and... Some rightful hatred for the oppressors here.
Yeah, I guess that part of it has never quite made sense to me. Like, this immediate kinship feeling she has right. with Bran.
And that's that. I think that's where this weird plastic concept of time in the series, where simultaneously you're supposed to understand everything that's happened in the entire series has been in like the last 6 months, but also it's taken 3 years of real world time and the children. So you can kind of like hop on both feet of that opinion. Like, oh, well, Asha's clearly been doing this for years and she's going to appreciate the Stark qualities, but also like, yeah, but she was just like a wildling ready to slit their throats 3 months ago. What the fuck? Mm-hmm. And that a lot of time works well in the show's favor.
All right. Then we go back to Dany, who's getting nervously impatient when Jorah shows up and says that the slave soldiers surrendered rather than fight for their masters. Jorah seems pretty disappointed when she asks about Daario, who promptly arrives behind them and pronounces the city hers.
It's a little bit of an owl licking the tootsie roll moment where Danny's like, how long does it take to sack a city? And it's like, that long exactly, Khaleesi, because here comes Jorah.
Yeah.
And Jorah's face when Dany asks, and what of Daario? What of the very unconventionally handsome and nether region moistening Daario, Sir Jorah? His face just like, it's so fucking womp womp.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. God, this guy. Set your sights lower, Sir Jorah. Come on now.
What is Jorah? Jorah's never given her a city. Come on. What has Jorah ever given her?
Grief. That's given her true. Grief yeah. and guff is what he's given her. No, I like that. And Daario looking badass as hell. He looks like fucking, he's covered in blood. He looks dangerous as hell. He looks hot as hell, in my opinion. There is some disagreement with me after my my pro Daario rant of last week that we'll consider in a spoiler section, but him presenting her the city's banner, I thought was a pretty nice moment. And also just like, yeah, this is where you concede to the better man, Jorah.
Yeah.
He's just outdone you.
He's younger.
He's younger.
Maybe better. I don't know. It's hard to tell. I mean, he's better looking, but he's given her a city.
Yeah.
You couldn't do that
for sure. I mean, you know, Dany is like 14. She's going to go for the guy who looks like he's the lead singer for Guns N' Roses over the guy who looks like he ran a Victorian era or Edwardian era newspaper on Downton Abbey.
Yeah, Daario could be in One Direction. I don't know about Jorah. Not Jorah. All right, the revelry begins at the wedding reception. Everyone except Roose is drinking. Walder and Rob jointly begin the bedding portion of the ceremony, a bedding for the wedding, and the bride and groom are carried off to their chambers. Talisa tells Rob that they should name their baby Eddard if it's a boy, and then the doors are closed behind them, and ominously the band begins playing The Reigns of Castamere. I'm going to stop it there because there's a minor scene of Arya and the Hound coming up. But it's very ominous. I mean, the end of that scene should tell you that something is fucked up here and bad things are about to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't. I don't think you play the Lannister theme song at the Stark Frey wedding unless bad shit is about to go down.
Yeah. But here again, the showrunners did such a good job of completely dismissing all of the tension.
Like, at the beginning of the scene, absolutely.
Everyone is having a good time. Kat is talking to her beloved uncle about, you know, their mutual like love for this idiot, you know, brother's nephew of theirs. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the droll story of Roose Bolton marrying one of the Frey daughters, and he picked
her weight in silver.
For weight in silver. So, of course, he picked the fattest one because Roose doesn't give a fuck.
Right.
You know, Roose might be an actual vampire.
Has she made you happy? She's made me very rich.
She's made me very rich, exactly. And then there's a little bit of, like, you know, Talisa taking shots at Cat, but not really. Rob interpreted it as that, but I think that there's no woman in less need of rescue than your mother is actually high praise in this society.
And this very sweet scene about naming the baby Eddard.
Yes.
That's great. I really like that scene a lot.
Right. Yeah, no. And Kat, like, looking on and pleased that all this is working out. And it's just great. Like, you have 5 solid minutes of, like, warm glow in your heart if you're a Stark fan.
And then
that's about to set you up for the... And the door swinging shut.
Yeah, it's super ominous. I love the end of this scene.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. No, so like I again, I really like the heart and the emotion that they brought in to the TV version, but there's unfortunately some things that I just don't know that would even play on screen, like the idea that Kat has been like questioning why the band is playing so poorly and out of time, because you come to appreciate that these are not people that play instruments; they're mercenaries that are pretending to play like badly, and they're, you know, to be deployed. It's like this.
Boy, he really packed the jury here.
yeah. No, there's just a lot of these things that like just these subtle things that like make everything seem wrong. And they do a little bit of the stuff. Like, I really like the reveal of, you know, Roos wearing his chainmail. Like, that's the, and then his like kind of smile to her,
and the immediate slap from Catelyn.
Yeah, and that's how that kind of sets things off. But like, it's really great, because right up to this moment, if you fell under their spell, you had no fucking clue. Not just, again, like I said, I kind of knew something bad was going to happen, but I was not expecting a total 100% defeat of the North. It's not just Rob's army. It's the whole fucking North.
It's all his
North.
Bannermen, the heads of all the houses.
The rest of, like, the only thing the only people got left is the leaderless Karstark, 2,000 mounted knights that are, you know, treasonous, and they went away. I mean, it's like there's nothing left of the fighting force of the North now.
Yeah.
So yeah,
that's a total defeat, but it all happens after this moment with Arya and the Hound, where they arrive at the gates but they're turned away and Arya sneaks off.
I like the gray, you know, because it starts with the doors being shut and the rains of Casimir, and then Grey Wind is outside whining because he knows something's wrong, because he's got the animal senses. And there's a little bit of humor here where the Hound's like, I got pork for the... He's like, oh, there's no feast. He goes, well, I got pig's feet. Like, oh, yeah, well... And there's like
Because earlier he said, this is the best part of the pig, and he's trying to entice the guy.
And there's like a three-second, like, stupid look this guy gives him where you're like, is this going to work? Is he going to Jedi mind trick with pig's feet? And the guy's like, oh, you soft in the head.
Get out of here, yeah.
It's pretty good.
It's great. So then the final climax of this episode happens. Catelyn senses something isn't right, and she figures out that Roos has betrayed them, and slaps him across the face. A battle breaks out inside as well as outside, as Talisa, all of the Stark Bannermen, and the direwolf outside is killed. Outside, Arya sees the death of the dog and tries to run to help her family, but the Hound, realizing it's too late, knocks her out and carries her away from the danger. Inside, Rob crawls to his dead wife. Catelyn takes Walder's wife hostage, begging him to let Rob live. Walder doesn't. He has Rob killed. Catelyn kills Walder's wife, and in the chain reaction, finally her throat is cut.
Yeah, this is the last time Kat will be able to be this wretchedly naive or optimistic about something that's going to... Because, like, you know, letting... Rob's not walking away. Rob's not walking out of this hall. He's got five crossbow bolts sticking out of him.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of great stuff in here that, because I say there's a few things I like that the book did better in the general kind of building creepy atmosphere. But the scene that they give Walder Frey of him, like, not nervously drinking, but like he's fully committed. But even still, even a guy as shit-tacular as Walder Frey kind of quails before just all of this bloodshed and violence and like this ripping of a pregnant woman's belly open. And like, he's like, nervously, that's not the right word for it. It's like what little left of his humanity is being sandblasted away by this.
Yeah.
And you know, also I think there is some real fear. Cause like in this society, can any man like be totally dismissive of the gods? Because regardless of what Tywin has promised you, you are just fucking lost. Like, this is the worst of the worst taboo you're committing, and particularly treacherous, terrible way of doing it too. And like they give that the Walder Frey that moment as a villain that like even he is shocked and kind of taken aback by what he himself has wrought. I thought was a great grace note for his character and makes him that much better of a villain.
Absolutely. And I got to say, the final shot of this scene is one of the most morbidly beautiful things I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Like, the way they give Catelyn a moment of just, like, pure fury and anguish and regret and she screams.
Yeah.
And they just linger on it.
Yeah.
For a good 5-10 seconds before someone comes up behind her and matter-of-factly cuts her throat.
Well, it's just like she reflexively cuts the Frey girl's throat because I guess she swore before the gods that she was going to do it. And like, but the scream kind of like peters out because she just has got nothing left. Like she is like, she has been completely cut off. Like it's weird that she's already, it's like her throat's been slit before it even gets slit.
And Rob had that moment not seconds earlier when Talisa was killed, right?
Right, exactly. Because
he stands up and he's like, mother, this is over. Yeah. As if to say, this is over.
Yeah.
We have made our bed. This is us lying in it.
Yeah.
And almost like, I'm sorry in a way too. Mm-hmm. Like, this is my fault and I apologize. But it's all in his face. You can see it.
No, yeah. And as well, like, you can see that, like, all simultaneously, not only that, but you can see that Kat sees the little boy that she gave birth to and has nurtured and loved this whole and been very proud of just moments ago. Like, she was at one of her happiest moments. And now she lives to see the last of her sons that she thinks taken from her. Mm-hmm. And it's the emotional payload is impressive. And what's going inside the hall, I think, was matched well with outside. Like the Arya, you know, trying to, she sees Grey win and there's opportunity. And I guess that's one of the other quibbles. This is definitely more of a gut punch, but the Stark loyalist in me would like to see Grey win gotten out of that pin and like, you know, take a bunch of Freys and Boltons with him.
Sure.
But the way he's that he's, you know, this is very emblematic of like, you know, this is all of Rob's strength, both in his men and his own vital energy and mm-hmm. his dire wolf that he's bound up. It's all being destroyed. And Arya is just so close to being able to make a difference here or there. And once again, she sees Grey Wind, she goes to free him and she gets halfway there and it's over before it begins.
Yeah. And at the end of this episode, I'm left with the words that Catelyn herself says at the beginning of the episode, which is, let them know what it feels like to lose the things they love.
Yeah.
And that describes Catelyn to a T.
The Lannisters
at the end of this episode
are just way better at it than you are.
Yeah.
And the moment of Grey Wind, like, you know, Arya and him like locking eyes as he dies. It's a great moment. Mm-hmm. It's a great moment. And then like, I wonder if there's anyone that bought the whole, like, hey, I've taken the young, I feel like this is a moment just to add the wretchedness of Kat's situation that like, does she would think that this would work? And when Frey finally says like, well, I'll just get another, was there a fan in the fandom that thought, oh God, this is there will be a floor. There will be a floor. It's not just going to be an empty black pit that we fall in forever.
No,
I don't think so.
No,
either.
I mean, everybody knew that Walder didn't give a shit about any of his family
members. It's more of just adding that extra bit of humiliation to like I said, it's her last opportunity to be foolishly optimistic and try to make, because, you know, how many times has she done this, like forced Jaime to pledge his honor to get back her daughters and all these other things she's done. And it's you know, and this is her, this is as hard as you can fail in the Game of Thrones.
Yeah. That's the end of the episode. Today's podcast is sponsored by HelloFresh. For a total of $60 off, that's $20 off your first three boxes, visit HelloFresh.com/GOT60 and enter GOT60.
Now, HelloFresh is a meal delivery service that shops, plans, and delivers step-by-step recipes and pre-measured ingredients that you can just cook, eat, and enjoy. It's delivered right to your door in recyclable insulated packaging. And I gotta say, I was worried when I got the last box because it's been hot as blazes in the Midwest here. It was a 95-degree day, and my front door faces full sunlight. And I got there, and I got there late. It was like 7. It was a late night, and I'm like, oh, God, none of this stuff is going to be good. I get it open. I crack it open. It's still all good.
And half the ice is probably still in the thing.
Yeah, it's like it's unbelievably well-packed. And the other thing is, like, every damn thing is recyclable. Mm-hmm. Every bit can be broken down and recycled, which is really cool because there is a lot of packing material. And, you know, they have something for everything. HelloFresh has three different meal plans you can choose from, classic, veggie, and family. You can rediscover the excitement of cooking, enjoy not having to plan dinner, spending money on takeout for an easy night, or worry about gathering ingredients week after week. These meal plans, a lot of times, are one pot. They take 20 to 30 minutes to cook and prepare. It takes at least that long to get in your car and drive somewhere and get back.
Yeah.
And it's nice. And that's the thing. Like, I do the majority of the cooking in my house, and the most of the drudgery is planning the thing, coming up with new ideas. Like, it's nicest to follow an easy follow plan and direction. It's simple and convenient. Like I said, there's a lot of one pot recipes for speedy cooking and minimal cleanup.
Yeah, because that's easily the worst part of cooking, in my opinion, is the cleanup.
Mm.
So, like, making that super easy. The one pots are probably my favorite recipes that they do.
Where
you just, like, throw in some ingredients, cook it, throw in some more ingredients, cook it, and you clean one pot.
We're the yin and the yang. I hate the planning, you hate the cleanup.
Right.
There are many benefits. We should get married. And then I can you do can all plan the all the meals, yep. And I can clean them all up.
Too bad you're already married.
Well, you know, there's always Utah. There's many benefits to subscribing, so you can keep enjoying HelloFresh week after week. Get out of that recipe rut and start cooking outside your comfort zone by discovering new and delicious recipes in each week's box. Jim, what's your favorite meal?
I think it's the one pots for the most part. This one is not a one pot, but it's easily my favorite taste-wise. Is their, they have this chicken and couscous recipe that has, like, this Dijon mushroom sauce,
mm-hmm.
that I really, really like.
I mentioned a couple times before that, like, I really like their poblanos and pork tacos, mm-hmm. and there's, like, one of their all-star Hall of Fame recipes, and I'll be damned if it wasn't in their box this last time. I wonder if they were listening.
Oh, they know.
It's so ridiculously good. Again, for a total of $60 off, which is $20 off your first three boxes, visit HelloFresh.com/GOT60. That's GOT60, and enter GOT60. That's like receiving six meals free, or up to 50% off your first three boxes. Again, go to HelloFresh.com/GOT60 and enter GOT60. That's GOT60. So we've been talking this episode about the reigns of Castamere. I'm here to talk to you about the clubs of Baldemir.
Mm-hmm.
Go to club.baldmove.com and you can find out all of the extra content that you're missing out. Not only are you missing out on supporting Bald Move, and why don't you want to? Like, you know, you've clearly been listening to a lot of our podcast. You're subscribed to our feed. You know, help us out. Help us make this sausage. Go to club.baldmove.com and see, not only do you get, it's not just altruism, you get a lot of bonus content, you get a lot of extra access, you get a lot of extra features. You can and you can try all of these features out by going to club.baldmove.com. We've got samples of all of them just free. Just check it out. If you haven't checked that, at least go to club.baldmove.com and look how goofy looking we are. Because you can take care of that. And then if you want to get your credit card out and sign up, you get a free 30-day trial. Conceivably try the whole thing, kick all the tires, check it out, support Bald Move, go to club.baldmove.com. We have feedback.
We do?
As you can imagine.
That's shocking.
GameofThrones@baldmove.com. Melissa's up first with some non-spoiler feedback. Hey, just listened to your show for Second Sons, and I heard you wondering about how closely matched Joffrey and Sansa's outfits at Tyrion and Sansa's wedding were. I think it's very intentional. In this video, what she includes, and I will include in the show notes for those
interested.
Don't click
it, it's a Rickroll.
In this video, she explains how Sansa's dress design is never going to give you up. And no, how Sansa's dress design and reads an interview right from the costume designer, Michelle Clapton. Her idea was that Cersei and the Lannisters had designed the dress. It has embroidery with a direwolf and a trout to represent her parents. Then a direwolf tangling with the lion wearing a stag crown. Finally, there's a big old lion head at the back of Sansa's neck, the Lannister's way of saying, you belong to us now. Her dress tells a story similar to how the astrolabe in the opening credits tells the story of Robert's Rebellion. Hmm. There's actually a lot of hidden imagery in the costumes, like Joffrey and Cersei both wearing fabrics that have patterns made of daggers. She also mentions the same channel has videos on most of the costumes, if that's something you'd like to check out. So I'm going to include the video in the show notes, and if you want to click through that and look at the other videos in the channel, if that's something you're interested in. I did watch it, and it is, I mean, it's, I love shit like that.
No,
like,
it's
I'm
so
the,
cool.
I'm the guy who's gone through all the special features on the Lord of the Rings Blu-rays, and this, it, like, I think when you can get everyone on fully on board of production, something magical happens where stuff, this every frame just drips these details that they're a mile wide and a mile deep. Like every little nook and cranny, every carving, every rune, every stitch tells a part of the story. And you know, it's stuff like this that makes me really impatient for shows to just half-ass stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like, what in today's day and age of the golden age of television, why the fuck do you bother with shows that are just all right? Mm-hmm. Shows that are just kind of okay. Like, why not go for something that's got this much fidelity in it? So thank you for sharing that with us, Melissa. Let's get on to Jeff. Jeff wants to know, why does Stannis want Robb's dead so badly that he would burn a leech in his name? I know he styled himself as King of the North, but I feel like it's just a rebellion against the Lannisters. It seems like if Stannis were to take the throne, Robb would be good at that. He doesn't seem to want the throne for himself and only wants revenge for his father. I also always got the sense that Ned and Stannis aren't necessarily friends, but do respect each other's honor and nobility and wouldn't just kill his son without talking to him, demanding his fealty. Okay. I wonder, do you know the answer to this question? I was going to give you a first crack.
I don't know if there is an answer. No.
Okay. It's my understanding that Stannis is an all or nothing kind of guy. And it's also my understanding that Robb is in a political situation where his bannermen will not accept a return to the Starks being lords paramount of the North. They want their king of the North back. Their Targaryens, their dragons are dead. You know, we're going to take back our proud lineage that stretched back for millennia until the last 300 years. And so you've got a guy in Stannis who is just genetically incapable of compromise. Like the idea that like, okay, well, you can be the king of the North as long as you've been there's no way Stannis will come to that accommodation. And there's no way that Robb can abdicate the throne without, you know, becoming a political pariah. So it's like one of those things where you're right. And that's something even I think Stannis makes a point to Kat in season two. Like your husband backed Michael. He was the first one to back my claim to a throne. And now your boy has raised his banners and he's declared himself king. Like that's a personal affront to him. So it's just, I think Stannis is personal and Robb's is political, but they're very much destined to the butt heads if the leech burning doesn't work. Hmm. Now,
did it work?
That's the million-dollar question.
Or were the wheels already in motion?
I mean, like, I think if you look back at this season, that I like to think that every time we walk in on Tywin writing long letters at his desk, that he is, you know, reaching. He's making entries to Roose. He's making entries to, because he can see. Like he can see the way the board is situated as well as Robb can, and what the natural play for Robb to do. Like I wonder how much like really how far this goes back to being architected. Like I would believe that right from episode one, that Tywin's already scheming and manipulating and maneuvering the end that we got, which means of course Stannis burning the leech didn't do shit.
Right.
But on the other hand, if you believe in royal blood, maybe, I don't know. I don't know. So, Jane W. says, this is slightly off topic, but I had to tell you. I just got back from seeing Peter Dinklage in a musical version of Cyrano de Bergerac. That's definitely how that's pronounced. But, you know, the one with the guy at the long nose.
Cyrano, yeah.
Right. I should have had you pronounce it. Adapted and directed by his wife, Erica Schmidt. It was in a small 200-seat theater, and I got to see him crazy up close. Sometimes I wonder if TV, movie stars, and actors are really that good or if it's just Hollywood magic. But I'm here to tell you that this guy tore up every scene right up. It's incredible how talented he is. And for what it's worth, his character is a soldier, and at one point, the army marches north to fight in a battle in the snow, and they win. So I'm taking that as an overall good omen for Game of Thrones. I tell you what, if you're not able to see him in a small, intimate 200-seat theater, I highly recommend you see the movie Station Agent if you want to see Peter Dinklage set a fucking movie set on fire. Mm-hmm. He's very young and very early in his career, but it's just a, like, he's got a couple of moments in the second and third act that he really generates a lot of like pathos and pain, and it's brilliant. Yeah, he's a great actor. Jay, I realize that season 3, episode 9 is really known for the Red Wedding, so I get maybe why other points of discussion could be missed. I'd like to discuss for a minute the scene where Jon won't kill the horse breeder and is ultimately outed as being a man of the Night's Watch. When the fight first begins, Bran intervenes by taking over Summer, and it appears that Summer kills at least a few couple of people. But what happens then? This brings up a bunch more questions like, once Jon got on a horse, did Bran slash Summer run away? Did the surviving wildlings even see Summer because it seems like they would have? Was there a conversation afterwards among the wildlings like, hey, did you see that giant direwolf? That was pretty crazy, right? It just seems funny that the direwolf gets involved and is gone without a trace. He's not wrong, right?
Yeah.
Like, these are giant, near the pony-sized wolves mauling your fellow wildlings, free folk, and nobody acknowledges that.
Yeah, it's just it's a really shocking thing to happen.
Especially Jon, who knows about and would probably recognize his brothers. I mean,
if not, at least it's a weird enough connection that he'd go, that was
because
interesting.
Because again, like, direwolves being south of the wall is something that's like, it'd be just as likely as us going out into your front yard here in southern Ohio and seeing a fucking timber wolf. Mm-hmm. It would like even if you didn't. And then if it just so happens that your brother had a timber wolf. Like, you know, it's weird that that happened, but I guess you're supposed to understand that the way it was staged and in the chaos of the battle that maybe people didn't notice.
Or at least didn't, like, keep track of it long enough. But damn, I mean, one of my major concerns in a battle involving direwolves would be, where the fuck is the direwolf at almost right. all times? If right. I'm not being actively attacked by a human, right. it's where is that direwolf?
Right, right, yeah, because I don't want any part of that direwolf. Right. I have no defense against this direwolf. Yeah, no, it's a little bit of an issue.
Also, I mean, if you really wanted to get to Jon, couldn't he have just, like, warged into the horse and brought Jon right back to the tower?
True. Horse minds are notoriously difficult to warg
into.
Are
they? Yeah, they're really intelligent creatures.
They have hooves. They're so, like, you know, like, it's so alien.
Just grab that horse by the brain and lead it back.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying.
I think I will say that, like, if I was going to say an additional criticism on top of this one, that I thought that the scene, this whole combat scene at that tower is very difficult to see where, like, you know, the hallmark of really well-shot action is you should always know where you are, where the combatants are, and where those are all in relation to the battlefield.
Yeah.
And good action scenes, you never feel like you are out of place or like, whoa, I just jumped over, like, I just jumped over my own point of view, and now I'm backwards, and I don't know. And this was shot in a way that I found pretty confusing. Mm-hmm. Like, I think a little bit more careful staging and editing, and maybe some of these questions would have been answered. Like, there's a low wall that Bran used to sneak up on the guys and drag them behind or something. I don't know. But I think a lot of the criticism is just that it's not necessarily a silly idea on the face of it, and the answers are probably there. It's just that it was shot in a confusing way that it's hard to see. That is all the non-spoiler feedback.
Okay.
Okay. So we're in the spoiler section now. We still have, we didn't get any more Theon torture scenes.
Nope.
Let me ask you this.
We do get one more in the finale, right? I mean, maybe. I know that sausage scene is coming up where Ramsay's eating sausage, but I don't know if it happens this season.
That could be this, or it could be episode 1, season 4. Yeah. I think that maybe we don't have a too much torture, but we have a torture pacing issue. Like, it's clear to me that if our torture count's at 5 or 6 now, and we're in episode 9, and we haven't really moved it, like, why didn't they do, like, every other episode, go cut back to the Dreadfort and see what's happening? I don't think it's necessarily important that the majority of the torturing happens before we get to the Red Wedding. Because I do feel like that they're, like, the first half of the season, the first 5 episodes, is super torture-heavy. And if they paced that out a little, because, like, they do have to tell the story of how they break this man, because they're not going to be able to, like they do in the books, put you inside Theon's head as Reek and have you slowly realize this broken the you know, almost mutant person is Theon Greyjoy. So they have to show how physically broken and mentally broken he is. And yet I know a lot of people, myself included, were critical of how, like, Jesus Christ, like, I get it. Maybe they could have paced it a little bit better. What do you think?
I don't know. I think it's a tough thing to do because, like you said, we need to understand that. Mm-hmm. And how do you do that on a television show where you have to show people what he's experiencing and show people what he's thinking?
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, if you don't go back to him over and over again, you probably wouldn't believe that he would be psychically broken.
Right.
So.
Right. Because that's the thing.
I don't know.
We're trained to see, like, you know, that, and this is a false view, but, like, heroic people can withstand torture. And if they're tortured once or twice, then, you know, then the good guys come and rescue them and they're right as rain. Mm-hmm. So, like, the Double D's knowing that, know they'd have to go the extra mile to be like, oh, this isn't just a run-of-the-mill. This isn't Arnold Schwarzenegger getting tortured in True Lies or whatever. This is, like, some really brutal shit going on. And then, you can't, without being able to reveal in the interior of a character's mind, all you have is the things you're doing to them and what that's, you know. And then
their reaction to it,
And it wasn't just, like, steady torture. It was also, like, Ramsay torture the guy and then give him hope. And then torture the guy and give him hope. And torture the guy and then, you know, sexually service him. And then torture and then cut off his... I don't know. I honestly feel... And I feel like it was a little bit much, but I don't have nearly as strong as opinion as I did... as I thought I would have it by the end of this season. Other thing I want to talk about is Arya versus the Hound. Arya vows to put a dagger through the Hound's eye socket. Do you think that that's actually going to happen in the final season? The Hound's been on her prayer list for a long time.
I don't think so. I really don't think so. I think in their travels, they get to know each other a little bit better. And I just don't feel, I guess, at the end, that animosity that they have at the beginning.
So Arya becomes a little bit more like the Hound, and the Hound becomes a little bit more like Arya?
Yeah.
Hmm.
And especially with, you know, where they have the Hound now. Like,
right.
I think he's a much better person in general.
Right.
So, no, I don't see it happening.
Yeah. Plus, like, the Hound, I mean, he might die in what I think, you know, is going to be something that I'm not going to say it's but it rhymes with the plebane coal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so I don't know. But that's something I thought was striking, that she's making this promise. And, like, man, now that everything's happened, I wonder what she'd do if she got him dead to rights. Also, the other thing about, like, no one can warg into humans is certainly not something in the book. In the prologue of, I can't remember if it's Feast or Dance, I think it's Dance, that introduce us to a character who, in, like, desperation, wargs into one of his fellow wilding women as he's dying. And it drives her insane. She starts ripping apart her face, and he has to flee from that body into a nearby wolf. But I wonder why they made it like a Bran only thing in the book or in the show. Is that just to further sell the, because that just muddies the water. Like it really, it really sells the idea that Bran is, like, special. He's the chosen one.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what they do a lot of stuff for, to show how special Bran is.
Yeah. Because it just muddies.
Because I think it's, like, one of the reasons they cut out a lot of the warging from the other Starks, right? And right. That, like, explicit link to the wolves, is to make Bran more special.
Yeah, and, like, I honestly think now that I've seen the show, that I don't know when the Double D's decided they're not going to do any of this complicated shit, but I think it's pretty clear that Martin has got this warging science worked out, just so you'll understand how Jon Snow can survive his resurrection and be psychically intact, in as opposed to, like, Kat Stark, or as opposed to Beric Dondarrion, that he's going to warg into ghost, his full consciousness, and he can rewarg back into his resurrected body. And then he is essentially, it's the ghost is refrigerator theory. But the Double D's are like, yeah, fuck all that. We're just going to have him be resurrected and pay lip service to he's been changed, but really he won't be.
Right. Just like Beric. Like, yes. Beric loses parts, but he's not, like, psychically changed.
And they
at all.
Jettison, like, yeah, that's a reason they jettison Lady Stoneheart, because everything that would muddy the waters of Bran being this uniquely powerful green-seeing warg chosen one, mm-hmm. is being eliminated in favor of of that clarity.
Yeah.
Okay.
Pure version of the hero's journey.
Right. Right. Do you have anything that you'd like to talk about before we get on to the spoiler feedback?
No, I'm ready.
Okay. Up front is Shaka. I believe I heard Aeron asking what the bastard names would be in the Crownlands when you were discussing Melisandre and the leeches. I'm pretty sure bastards in the Crownlands, at least in King's Landing, are named waters based on the Blackwater. I'm getting this from a feast for crows. When Cersei appoints someone named Arrain Waters to the Small Council, and I remember that being the explanation. Hmm. Yeah, I actually looked, and I don't know. It's very hard for me to memorize all these things, but bastards in the Crownlands are waters. Bastards in Dorne are sand. Bastards from the Iron Islands are called pike. The north, of course, is snow, as in Jon Snow. In the reach, the bastards are called flowers. In the Riverlands, they're called rivers. Stormlands are called storm, and the Vale of Arryn is stone, and Westerlands, where the Lannisters are from, are hills. So, Shaka also has a simple question. If there is one character who has been killed off that you could have back in the show and not screw up the storyline, who would it be? For me, it'd be Tywin. I know it would ripple out and make everything different, but I would love for him to still be in King's Landing when Dany finally returns with her full force.
Yeah, I would love to see the battle between a superior force that Dany has and a potentially superior mind that Tywin
has. What's Tywin's answer for dragons? It's kind of like Lex Luthor versus Superman. That should be a route, but Lex Luthor's a super genius and maybe he's got kryptonite.
Right, right. No, that's a really, really strong one. I mean, bringing back Ned would be awesome just because he's Sean Bean.
That would just flip the whole story table over.
Right, the rippling consequences there make the show not possible.
I think the best, for me, I bring back Barristan Selmy.
Ah, okay.
Because I don't think his death was that important. He's not dead in the books, and he actually has a really badass duel with someone that came to, to try to assassinate the queen, or I forget exactly, but he kills this this pit fighter with his old Kingsguard ways, and it's just a really badass scene. And he did have a little bit. I mean, he went out he died with his boots on, like an old warrior should. But I feel like, there's just a lot of nice scenes between him and Dany talking about the good old days of Targaryens, and he's just such a, he's one of the last of the good Kingsguard, and now he's serving this virtuous queen. Like, I think it would have been a good, I'd love to see what Barristan would say to her in the council. Like, he would have been a good foil for Tyrion, because Tyrion's all real politic. Barristan still believes in the ideas of, chivalry. And righteousness and justice, and it would have been a nice counterpoint to that, because she's not getting a lot of that from Varys and Tyrion. But then again, I guess that would also take a lot of what she's getting from the Jon side of the equation too.
I mean, I can think of a lot of characters that I'd like to have back, but
yeah.
I think I can do one better than Tywin, and that's Oberyn, because then you get Tywin too.
Yeah,
right.
True.
And then the ripples, because Oberyn's such a good character, it would potentially have some effects on the really shitty Dorne stuff that we see in the following seasons, because none of that would be necessary. Tywin wouldn't die, most likely. I feel like Oberyn might be my number one choice, because he's an awesome character.
I wish I had the Winds of Winter so I could see what Dorne's plan, what his evolved plan's going to be for Dorne, because Dorne's such a hot mess. But man, I really like what is it, Julian Bashir? What? No, that's his character name. Alexander
Siddig.
Yeah,
that's the DS9 character name, yeah.
I really like his take on Prince Doran. I thought he was impeccably cast. They just didn't fucking do a damn thing with him.
And I think that saves him, too, right? If Oberyn doesn't die?
Well, I don't know.
Because doesn't Ilaria want him to go avenge Oberyn's death, and refuses,
and she takes him out. And he never gets to give his fire and blood speech. They give that to Varys a season later. It's such, ugh. I wish Dorne just ceased to exist after Oberyn died, if that's what they're going to do with it.
Right.
The other one, I really enjoyed the character of Roz. I think she is just super good looking, and there's very few commoners that are in the Game of Thrones that you can see. Like, it's a way to understand Varys's rise. by seeing her rise, and like I was really excited the idea of like, oh, they're taking her in a direction of being his like lieutenant, and that would be, you know, that would be super fucking cool to see her like being tootled under this, you know, the master of spies and whispers. So I miss Roz as well. And she was, I thought they struck her down just as she was getting interesting. All right. That's pretty good consideration of that question, I think. We'll move on to Ryan J. I've been thinking about the maneuvers between the Lannisters and Tyrells through season 3 and how they repeatedly use marriage to tie up alliances or help control alliances. However, did both Tywin and Olenna miss the greatest marriage matchup possible by not wedding each other? Both are shrewd, move best behind the scenes of power, knew how to play the game, and potentially outplay each other. Best of all, both knew that in the Game of Thrones, you win or you die. A marriage alliance between the Tywin and Olenna, coupled with the wedding alliance of their grandchildren, would have been given both families control of Westeros. Olenna's friendly overtures to Sansa could have helped secure the North post-Red Wedding without forcing further wedding alliance, knowing that the Tywin's deal with the Boltons would mean military control of the territory anyway. Sansa could have been shipped off to the Reach as far from the North as possible and remained there until such future time as she may be needed. Why does the devious not bump uglies with the decrepit?
Because, A, it's gross. It's gross. I don't want to think about that. B,
there ain't nothing gross about Diana Rigg.
It's just, it's not her. It's the age. It's just an age of a human being at that point. Nothing good happens there. B, how much does it really change? Because, like, this dynasty thing,
right?
Like, without the marriage of Joffrey and Margaery,
they're saying do that.
What does Olenna get out of that?
That's the thing.
And if you're gonna do that too, then why do the first one? Why do Tywin and Olenna? Because the important thing is right. Joffrey and Margaery.
I will say that I think you're supposed to understand in the books that Tywin. This is another example of Tywin's hypocrisy. The fact that, you know, he hated his father's softness for, you know, women, and he hates Tyrion's whoring around, yet his wife dies, and the reason cited for him not remarrying is the fact that he mourned his genuine love for Joanna Lannister, and also the fact that he shits on Tyrion for enjoying whores, but then takes a whore to, you know, as Tyrion finds out, he's been a hypocrite all the time. Him forcing his children in these loveless marriages, even after, like, in the Cersei's case, she's been through a fucking reign of terror with Robert Baratheon already, and he himself, his wife died young. He could have remarried and used his own, like, he's a fucking badass. He could have remarried his own damn self to help the family dynasty, and he chose not to. That's the interesting hypocrisy of Tywin. He can see with 20/20 vision everyone else's fates and how they, but he has got a giant blind spot when it comes to himself. And he also doesn't, and his bitterness and resentment over Tyrion blinds him to his child's qualities. Like, it's the Tyrion's arguably the best of them.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's a flaw. I think that's, well, it is a flaw. It's a character flaw that makes him an interesting and believable villain. Mm. So, like, I guess I don't have a problem with, you know, like, yeah, but him and Olenna are way too old by the time the Game of Thrones comes out. But there's a legitimate argument 10, 15, 20 years ago. Why didn't he do that?
30, 34, 30, maybe. 30, yeah.
Because he's, well, everyone's younger in the Game of Thrones. Like, I think Tywin's like in his late 40s, or early 50s, or something like that.
Yeah.
No one's as old as they look. Ons. Someone asked in the Second Sons podcast why there are no clockwork mechanisms for locations north of the wall. The way I understood it, the opening credits were meant to be the armillary spears within the citadel in Old Town. So the maesters wouldn't have any real knowledge of what's north of the wall. It'd just be, there be ice dragons there. I don't know why I buy that. Like, I get it that they might not know where, like, specific wildling settlements like Hardhome would be, but, like, the Night's Watch knows about the Fist of the First Men, and they know about the Frost Fangs, and they know about the river. Like, absolutely, they would at least know where Craster's Keep is. They would know about the Fist of the Northmen. I don't know. Like, it's not like the Maesters don't know or believe in anything north of the Wall. And, like, any human knowledge that people possess, they too would possess. They fucking have a Maester at the Wall. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no way they don't know about that stuff. So I think it's still a little bit of a cop out. Although it's the best cop out I've heard. Any thoughts, or should we keep moving on?
Keep going.
Andrew E. Hey, guys, just want to respectfully disagree on your take about old Euro Dario versus the new one. Personally, and we had a lot of takes, some from women, this one from the man, a man that I enjoyed, and I'm going to read it. Personally, I've always loved the second Dario much more because, first of all, he's much, much, much hotter than Euro Dario. Secondly, in lieu of the edge that Euro Dario had, new Dario brings an endearing boyish charm and swagger that lets me buy his romance with Danny. He's the hot young buck, and though I might not... and though it might not be all that's what's in the books, for me, the performance works. I never bought Euro Dario, mostly because of that hideous wig they gave him. I'd sit and stew in the tub long before getting up for Euro Dario, but new Dario could get it all and then some. Hey... I disagree with you, brother. I think Euro Dario would be the one that I'd let stew in my tub.
I mean, Danny's a teenager. She's going to go for the bad boys. And it, and new Dario is not a bad boy.
He's not a bad boy. He's not.
He's a more of a teddy bear than a bad boy.
And I agree. Like, here's the other thing is I kind of agree with your take on the wig, but I feel like that's the showrunners trying to play up the flamboyishness, the flamboyantness of the book Dario. Like, they can't give him a purple forked beard and gold teeth, but they're going to give him, like, some weird braids and shit to show that he's different. He doesn't have sex with property, unlike all these other Philistines that he associates with. I mean, clearly, this is a subjective difference. Everyone's sexual taste in people is different. I'm just saying, I feel like Euro Dario is a lot more interesting.
Let me throw this possibility out there, that new Dario might actually have been... perceived to be sexier and more edgy had he been given the material that Euro Dario was given. Because Euro Dario gets to walk in and say all the sexy lines, right?
Like,
you can't make love to a slave, that kind of stuff.
I serve beauty.
Here's the city for you, my queen. Like, that kind of shit. New Dario doesn't get that because old Dario already did it.
You're right. New Dario is kind of just stuck being the lovesick person to get spurned by Danny for her dream, her destiny.
So maybe if he's given that material, we'd view him differently. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. Andrew says, also as a point of clarification, old Dario is doing quite well for himself. So I talked about him being cast in a transporter, which was true, but he's also the principal villain in the first Deadpool movie, which turned out to be the highest rated grossing R-rated film of all time. Then last year was cast in the Hellboy reboot, directed by Game of Thrones alum director Neil Marshall. However, after it was revealed that the role he had been cast in was Asian in the source material, making this a whitewashing casting, he very publicly and famously left that project, which got him a lot of goodwill from the industry and the general public, which then led him to land the role of one of the key villains in James Cameron and Robert Rodriguez's upcoming cyberpunk anime adaptation of Alita Battle Angel. So he's landed on his feet. That's cool. Like, and as soon as you said Deadpool, I immediately like, oh, yes. I think on the balance, two more seasons of kind of weak Dario material was probably not worth staying around for if you could be the lead villain in Deadpool and work with James Cameron and Rodriguez. What do you think?
I don't know. I don't remember him in Deadpool. Well, was he all CG or something?
No. He's the guy to like, this is the chief like torturer and tormentor of Wade. Well, he didn't land for Jim.
No, he didn't stick in my mind.
Sean McGee, on the discussion of prophecy and determinative gods, I found it was interesting, but we have hard evidence of people with predetermined fates, the green seers. By its very nature, the ability to green see or stand a seeing a great battle in the snow suggests a predetermined future. That certainly makes any plot less interesting. However, although I'm not sure why, when we start a book, it has a predetermined end and it's still interesting. Perhaps it just makes life less interesting.
Does it? Or because we also see Bran potentially influencing the past from the future, wouldn't that say that it's not deterministic?
I'm always impressed by people. Well, not impressed. I'm always surprised, I should say, that people will take pretty nebulous on-screen things and then say definitively that this means this can happen and all that. Because, like, here's my thing about Destiny. So Jojen had a dream that he was going to die a particular way in service of a particular goal. Then he went and lived his life in service of that. Is that his destiny, or did he have a dream that he wanted to fulfill?
Right, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy kind of thing.
Right, right. Like, you know, once upon a time I had a dream of being a professional podcaster, now it's happened. But if I had have been like, oh, this dream is stupid and dismissed, and I just stayed at my job, and then, like, I mean, it's... I would like a Jonah situation where, like, Jojen has the dream and tries to run in the opposite direction from it, and everything returns him to the original path. Then we can start talking about definitive destiny. The Stannis thing's not persuasive because, like, a lot of the shit that Melisandre saw was wrong, and the stuff that was right, Stannis tried his best to fulfill in the real world and failed at it. So, like, I'd have to see a person getting their destiny and then bucking it. Because so far, I haven't seen that. I see people getting their destiny, and they see that as the call to adventure. And then sometimes they succeed, sometimes they fail. So, I don't know. I think there's still the jury's out about how much fate and destiny actually play in the Game of Thrones. Catherine H., I really love the idea that Martin not so much likes to surprise us or mess with us, but rather he's telling the hero myth just many, many years after the fact. I believe this is an idea that I originally heard floated on your podcast a while back. Well, I'm happy to take the credit. I don't remember it, but she continues, we think the hero is Ned or then Rob, but it's actually been John all along. The hero normally comes from a messed up childhood and has to overcome all sorts of odds and rise to be the leader. But instead of just being told that about John, we witness all the messed up stuff that happened to him to make him the hero he was in season 7. With that in mind, does that change the way you think about the first 3 seasons or the first few books? For me, I pay a lot of attention to the way John learns about both Ned and Rob's deaths. They are not the end of our hero stories, but rather the inciting incidents. Mm-hmm. It also lets the show off the hook for not surprising us anymore. We are now knee-deep in typical hero myth storytelling. But I always appreciate the unusual road we took to get there. So she's saying, like, Star Wars is the hero's journey, right? But if you properly understand it, the hero's journey begins in episode 1. And here we're getting, like, the first 3 books are essentially episodes 1, 2, and 3. And then we get started with, you know, Jon Skywalker.
Right.
You know, getting his lightsaber and being and being taken under the wing by Obi-Wan Kenobi. That's a good way to look at it. That it's not so much a subversion, but Martin just really going back to first principles on this whole hero's journey thing.
Mm-hmm. No, I like it. And it doesn't. I guess it doesn't dim my view of the first 3 seasons, as you're saying here, because those seasons were also extremely interesting to watch for right. me. And yes, they might be a prelude to the real story, the real hero's journey, but I'm okay with that because I had a lot of fun watching him.
Yeah, and like I don't think it enhances or de-enhances because I think it's just a little bit of tomato-tomato, too, because whether he's subverting the conventional storytelling structure or just really being digressive and telling the hero's journey, like, it's a little bit the same because the hero's journey does not usually belabor how the hero got to... You know, the hero's introduced, he gets his call to adventure, he goes on. We don't need to see the hero being born and his parents die and his brother fail and his... Like, that would just all be backstory.
We do see a lot of that. Like, specifically in Star Wars, right? His aunt and uncle are killed.
Right.
He's got this old wizard telling him things into his ear. Right. Like, all that happens, but it's so condensed. It's like 15 minutes.
And it leaves out his father and mother and their tragic relationship that eventually put him on that course. And, like,
it's all alluded to, and it's all there. The difference being in Game of Thrones, we're shown that stuff.
Right. And then, like I said, you know... it's almost like exactly the same. It's just like the first 3 prequels aren't that good, but like you can easily see the, you know, Game of Thrones, Clash of Kings, and the Storm of Swords being the prequel trilogy that then explains how Jon got at the wall and is in a situation where he now can be the leader. One of the king or queens that might save the world.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it's interesting, like, looking back through the opposite end of the telescope way of looking at the story there, Catherine. And that's all the feedback we got for this week. We will be back next week, are we going to have a wrap up? I think some people have asked me this week, are we going to have a wrap up podcast?
I don't think that's in the plan.
I don't think so. 'Cause here's the deal. I'm coming right back in November to cover. I think we're going to have at least 2, maybe 3 weeks of Fire and Blood coverage, where I'm going to literally like divide that book. This is the Targaryen history into 3 sections, and we're going to talk about insights. That's also around the time that my Game of Thrones book is going to be released, so might have my co-author Anthony LaDon on to talk about that. And you know, just talk over people's questions and stuff about that. So like in just a couple months, we're going to come back, and then a couple months after that, I mean, we know for a fact that Game of Thrones is coming back in April of next year. Mm-hmm. So like, I don't feel like there's a real need to like tie everything up into a nice neat bow, because I don't feel like we're ever really going to go away. So,
and after that, there's a new series to do.
And after that, there'll be a new series of that. So like, yeah, I don't think we'll go be doing a wrap up, because, you know, a lot of wrap up is also a lot of just spec, you know, kind of what do we learn? Mm-hmm. What's still open for next season? Well, that's that in the context of a series that's already wrapping up in season 8, that doesn't make a lot of sense.
Right.
So, no, but we will wrap up the season next week with the final episode.
Yeah. And I think we're going to do a portion of what you might consider a wrap up at the end or during that podcast.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
like we'll talk about
our
feelings on the season.
Maybe we can actually give some thought about what the strength of the season's overall.
Yeah.
Yeah. As, we've been promising that for an entire season. Uh-huh. Although I'm tempted to just wait till season 8 comes out and see what happens. But, thank you for all your feedback. Can't wait to wrap this up next week. We will see you then at that time. Until then, I'm Aaron.
No, I'm Jim.
Later.